Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. Some of you may have seen that famous 2011 TED Talk by Norina Hertz about how to make good decisions and why so many people don't. Well, now the University of I got to look up. She moved universities. Let's see. She is at University College London. Forgive me. So the University College of London management professor is out with a book called Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. The Observer has called Norina Hertz one of the world's leading young thinkers. The Guardian calls her one of Britain's top public intellectuals. Her work was an inspiration for Bono's Red Project, which matched corporate profits with an anti-AIDS campaign in Africa, and much more. And we welcome Norina Hertz to WNYC. Hello from New York. Thank you very much for coming on with us.
Hello, Brian. I'm delighted to be on your show.
And I'll mention that the book opens with four scenarios. So to give people an idea of the range of decisions you're writing about, they are a mother deciding whether to comfort her crying baby or let him fall asleep on his own, Warren Buffett deciding whether to sell his shares of Coca-Cola or buy more, you trying to decide whether to let a doctor operate on your father in the next 24 hours, and a president of the United States deciding whether to order a military strike on Iran. So this is about big decisions from the global to the very personal?
Yes, high-stake decisions, decisions that really matter, whether it's to do with our health, our wealth, our relationships, our work.
And you have a long list of ways to make good decisions in general, which we'll go through some of. But isn't the biggest thing in each of those cases the quality of information you have? Like, do you know the science about whether ferberizing babies, making them cry themselves to sleep, breeds independence or trauma, or the details of Iran's intentions, or whatever information?
Gathering the right information is absolutely key. I mean, it's a message that I say time and time again in the book, the need to be a smarter information hunter-gatherer. But being smart is not necessarily what we would initially think, because, you know, one group of people who we often turn to for information are experts. And as my research uncovered, experts actually can lead us very badly astray.
One of the themes of your book is information overload, including the distractions of everyday technology in our lives, like texts and emails. Is that really a big factor in good decision-making once we get down to it?
It really is, time and time again. And I interviewed really smart decision-makers, from hedge fund honchos to Hollywood moguls, from fighter pilots to ER doctors. And time and time again, these people said to me that one of the most important things was to actively carve out time and space to think. Even ER doctors said that. People who I would have expected in, you know, to make their decisions just so instantly, they said that even they would consciously slow their decision making down and take that time, especially when it mattered. So what I found was that we all feel it, don't we? We are so bombarded with information and with distractions, with emails and texts and Facebook posts and tweets. And Microsoft did some research which showed that every time, for example, we get an email alert or we're distracted by an email, it takes us 22 minutes to get back to the same level of focus.
Come on, 22 yeah, minutes?
22 minutes. So some of us will never, ever, ever get back to any level of focus. Yeah. So, but it makes sense, that need to carve out thinking time. And it's something that I ask people who I'm working with. I advise some global political and business leaders. And one of the first questions I ask them is, how much time do you carve out every day to think? And so rarely will any of them say, I do. But once they're aware of it, then they start scheduling it in.
It's a great point. I know for myself, in my busy life, one of the things that I always try to do is take myself to lunch by myself once a week. And at very least that, it's thinking time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I take a digital Sabbath, or at least try to, where I have one day a week where I don't go online, where I don't check my emails.
So listeners, let's try something. You can call in and ask Norina Hertz about a decision you have to make, and let's see what happens. Now, her job is not to tell you what to do. We're not that kind of advice show, you know, where the host or the guest pretend we know you well enough to tell you whether to divorce your husband or whatever from a 30-second on-air phone call. You've all heard those kinds of shows. Rather, Norina Hertz can talk to you about how to make the best decision for yourself, like she talks to world leaders and conflicted regular folks herself, and in her book, Eyes Wide Open. So the phones are wide open for your questions about decisions you have to make at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or use our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show to post your question. And as your calls are coming in, I'll note that, Norina, one of the themes of your book is knowing when to trust expert advice and how to decide which experts to trust. So maybe a good place to start with that is close to home. Since you've written a book of expert advice here yourself, how would you recommend that people evaluate your book and you?
Well, firstly, I admit I am an expert, so I am labeled as such. And so I'm aware of the irony here that I'm saying be careful. Be careful of what experts say. But I think we do differ a lot. We differ a lot in our humility. And actually, there's research that shows that the more overconfident or the more confident seeming an expert is, often the worse they perform. There was some very interesting research done on radiologists, which showed this sort of result. So experts do differ. I think also when you're looking at experts, be aware, or considering expert advice, be aware that they really move in packs and that there are very particular camps. I mean, we see it, of course, when it comes to the economy. We see it when it comes to politics. But we see it in things like medicine too. I mean, very, very different views and opinions. I got really interested in expertise and understanding experts more when I got very sick about 6 years ago. And I was struck down with a mystery illness. I was in terrible stomach pain. I lost a lot of weight. And I went to see a number of different experts, including in the States, and was really struck at how different their diagnoses were, how divergent. And I started looking at experts as a cadre. And I saw that with medicine, for example, doctors misdiagnose one time in five. And 50,000 people die every year in the United States and Canada who wouldn't have died otherwise because of misdiagnosis. And I started thinking about my field, economics, where, of course, you just have to think of the financial crisis. I mean, that was a whole group of experts.
Alan Greenspan assured us everything would be okay with the housing market.
Absolutely. Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers, it was all going to be great. Derivatives were fantastic products. Bernie Madoff, I mean, he was an expert who people were rushing to be looked after. So we had, and I just want to be clear that I'm not saying don't trust doctors and don't trust medicine. I'm just saying we have to keep our brains switched on, and we have to be willing to be the challenging client, the challenging patient.
And it's complicated. I mean,
yes.
If you're going to get educated yourself in how to read your medical test results because you don't trust your doctor to give you a proper interpretation, it's a dicey business, matching wits with people who've gone to med school and more importantly, read many test results every week over a period of years.
Mm. So there is a question of, is there somebody in your network who you can deploy to help you? So, of course, you know, if you've got a sore throat or a cold, this isn't the time to call in that favor. But if something's seriously wrong, is there someone in your community who can help you figure things out, who can just help you piece together the right questions or a list of questions to ask when you go and see your doctor?
Norina Hertz, author of Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. We listed earlier some of the top thinkers and educators and world leaders and economists and people in business and people like that who she has advised or inspired, as in the case of Bono. And maybe you saw her hit TED Talk a couple of years ago. And now we're going to take some phone calls with some decisions that you are trying to make. And maybe we can all learn some lessons from Helena Hertz advises that you go about trying to make them. So Kate in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kate. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a baby that's 2 months old, and we're contemplating moving from a one-bedroom to a larger apartment. But there's also risks involved. We really like our location. It's really quiet, and we really value having a quiet apartment.
And so the question is, should you move for space versus
yes.
noise? So, okay, Norina Hertz, apply your methods to Kate's decision. There's you know, kind of a fundamental trade-off.
Sure. Well, first of all, with a two-month-old, you're probably not getting enough sleep, are you?
Yeah, not completely. And there's another complication because my husband works at night and sleeps in the day. So, you know, that's why we're also concerned about having a quiet place.
Right. Well, I'm thinking when it comes to decision-making, there's a lot of research that shows that when we're at periods where we're not getting enough sleep, these are not good times to make big decisions if we can help it. Because when we're fatigued, if we're spending only 4 or 5 hours a night sleeping, it actually turns out that that's as if we were making decisions drunk. So I think, so for big decisions, a period where you're really very sleep deprived, which you must be with a 2-month-old baby, it's probably not exactly the right moment to be deciding whether or not to move. So I'd say that as a first step, because actually our physical and our emotional states really affect our decisions. When it comes to weighing up what's more important to you, noise or space, yes, mm-hmm. which seems to be what you're weighing up, I guess. At the moment, you're presenting it to me as a very black and white decision, noise or space. Is there a possibility of having less noise and more space? Is there a third way that you haven't yet discovered that is worth pointing out and looking for yourself? Would be something else that immediately springs to mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Kate.
Okay.
All right.
Yes. All right. If you want to, I guess you want to take other people, but I could go on and on about this, but I know you probably want to take other
people. Well, go ahead. Give us one quick follow-up to what you just heard.
Well, we also like that the rent is a good price, and we don't really want to pay that much more for the extra space, and we think we could, you know, try to make it work here. So that's another, you know, complication.
Right. Kate, thank you very much. So good luck with all that. But on
yes,
the advice that you gave, Norina, to not make big life decisions when you're sleep deprived because mm-hmm. you have a 2-year-old. I mean, not everybody with a 2-year-old can suspend all big life decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. So try and make sure that there's somebody who you can bounce your thinking off who is getting enough sleep when it's a big decision.
Monica in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Monica.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Hi,
Monica.
Thank you. Love your show. Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. I have a law degree that I haven't used in about 10 years, and I've had a job that has been good, but I don't see a future in it. I see it as a very dead-end job, and you know, there's been a lot of layoffs, and there's just not a whole lot of job security, which I guess is just kind of everyone's, or a lot of people are faced with that. But I have been thinking about hanging a shingle, going out on my own, starting a practice for probably at least 2 years. And I guess the big dilemma for me is that I make a decent amount of money and I have a lot of flexibility in my current position. And I feel like our family can live on my husband's income. Everything I make is extra for our current lifestyle. But I'm just not sure whether at the age of almost 40, this is the time to take that chance.
So the question is whether to take the risk to leave a dead-end job, but that's secure, to go out and try to start your own law firm
for something that I can do in my 50s and 60s. You know, like as I get older, I feel like it's just something that I will be mine, and no one can say, "Oh, sorry, this, you know, we decided to have layoffs and you're at this time."
Well, I think your issue is something that a lot of people are actually confronting, especially that jobs with big corporates are no longer jobs for life, where you can guarantee even that that job will last moving forward. And I appreciate this is a big decision that you're having to make. One thing that I do with clients is what I call the circle of truth. And what that is draw a circle and put in that circle the things that really matter to you. Maybe it's your family, maybe it's health, maybe it's job satisfaction. You know, we've all got different things that really matter to us. And then match where you are today with your circle of truth. How much does that correspond? And if it doesn't, which it sounds like in your case it may not, because it sounds like job satisfaction is something you do value and you don't have at the moment, then you probably need to move in that direction. I think also with decisions that are small but also big decisions, it is important to set a deadline on when you're going to make the decision by, because just that process enables you to focus, plan, and actually get moving one way or the other. And the period of indecision can often be a really angst-ridden period.
That's great. Thank you so much. I will have to listen to the podcast and listen to the advice again.
Listen very carefully. And another thing that occurs to me on your situation is that you said you're almost 40. Well, it's just not that old.
Yes, so true.
To go out and take some risks rather than feel like you might be stuck in a dead-end job for the next 30 years, you know?
Right. I have seen colleagues who are older, like in their 50s, who've sort of, you know, don't have any additional skills to offer than these, like, you know, corporate-type skills that, unfortunately, in this day and age, don't really seem to be that marketable, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's just so much age. I see so much ageism in corporate culture, and it scares me to be that person, you know, in 15 or so years. I feel like it would be maybe a better move for me to take a chance while I'm still young enough that I can have that flexibility, and while I have, like, the ability to, you know, that luxury of being able to do it.
Monica, thanks, and good luck. My guest is Norina Hertz, author of Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. And I think through both of these first two calls, we're hearing that you've got decision-making techniques. It's not about knowing their personal situation so much, as we said at the outset, but
right.
Like you told her to set a deadline for her decision. So she actually takes action in one direction or another. You told the previous caller with the 2-year-old deciding whether to move or not to make sure that she's got a circle of advisors out there if she's under stress as a mother of a toddler. So those are some examples of the kinds of decision-making skills that are applicable to different kinds of situations that you focus on.
Absolutely. And there are really tangible things that we can do to help our decision-making process.
Here's one on our website. Katie writes, please help us find a framework for deciding, so she gets it, framework for deciding, whether to have a second kid. We're older parents, so we need to decide ASAP. Love our kid, love our life, and worry about upsetting the apple cart, though we want our daughter to have a sibling. Have you ever dealt with this one with a client or anyone?
I haven't. And obviously, again, it's a big, big decision. You love the person who's written in. I mean, they love their kid and they love their life, and that is something to definitely think about. Obviously, having another child brings a whole host of unknowns into the equation. Lots of potential, wonderful possibilities, but unknowns too. But it's a big decision. It's a decision that definitely, I think I haven't dealt with this particular case, but one lesson that I've learned in my own research is that our emotions really affect our decisions. So if we're feeling stressed or anxious, we can feel more tunnel visioned. We can feel more risk averse. If we're feeling particularly happy, we will feel more willing to take risks. So I'd say whether it's a small decision or a very big decision like this, one useful exercise, and it's just one thing to do in this whole process, obviously, is to consciously note your emotional state. How are you feeling? What is your mood? Recognizing that that itself could be leading you in one direction or another, allowing you to focus on the upside or the downside of a potential decision. And it turns out just by noting our emotions, that act itself serves as an emotional thermostat and helps regulate our decision making.
I noticed in the emotional thermostat section of the book that you give an intriguing example of people whose relatives win the lottery and they are offered a small share of the winnings. And in some cases, people take it, and in some cases, people don't take it. But you find an interesting emotional thermostat lesson in who does what. Could you tell us that story?
Yes. Well, it's a very classic example that is used in economics to see people's decision-making ability and power. You ask them if they want to, their relative wins money in a lottery, they give them a very small percentage of what they won. Will you accept it or not? The rational thing to do, of course, is to accept the money, because even if you're just given $100 from somebody who's won $1 million, $100 is better than nothing. But people allow their emotions to come into play and they feel angry that they're only being offered $100. They feel jealous. And so they typically choose not to take any money at all, which is an irrational choice. But there was one group of people who, it turns out, do make the rational choice. And that was monks, Buddhist monks. Now, these are people who are very well practiced at noting their emotional states. Mindful training is very much about noting how you're feeling. And this group of people consistently made better financial decisions in this regard. And in fact, in general, when they were given a whole host of financial decision tests, monks did better than average people.
So when you have to decide how to invest your money, don't call Alan Greenspan. Go to the airport and speak to the nearest Hare Krishna.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Maybe not. In our last few minutes, to return to the examples on page one of your book that we started with, do you take a position on, for example, letting babies cry themselves to sleep or routinely comforting them at those times?
I think it's a case of reading the research, looking at the experts, but also reaching out to your own social network, because there's a group of people we often ignore when it comes to getting advice, who I call lay experts, people with experience who may not have formal qualifications. So why not post on Facebook, who's got children, any recommendations you have on getting your child to quiet at night? You might well get better advice than from any of these baby care books.
And your other example, should Warren Buffett have bought more Coca-Cola stock or sold?
I'm not sure when I wrote that and where Coca-Cola was, but when you're looking at financial decisions, one thing is to make sure that, again, you're gathering your intelligence inevitably. Nowadays, when we're tracking stocks and shares, don't only look at annual reports and the obvious information that's out there. Do track on Twitter what's being said about the company. Do look at social media. You can preempt crises before they actually hit the media.
Do you write about certainty and being opinionated? I know people who will hear a situation described and immediately say, here's the best way to handle it, while others are just figuring out what questions to ask. Can either of those be ideal?
I would err towards the latter. I think especially in a world that's as fast-moving and fast-changing as ours, certainty is really likely to be especially illusory.
Noreena Hertz from University College London has authored Eyes Wide Open, How to Make Smart Decisions in a Confusing World. I guess on one level, it's a book-length treatment of that very widely shared TED Talk that she gave in 2011. And thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. still to come. We will check out Daniel Campo's new book. It's a book that Sam Roberts of the New York Times lists as one of the top five that Mayor-elect de Blasio must read before taking office. It's The Accidental Playground, Brooklyn Waterfront Narratives of the Undesigned and Unplanned. Daniel Campo next.